Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
When it comes down to it, what are we at our core? We are North American waterfowl. Hello and welcome to another episode of the North American Waterfowler Podcast. Tonight we are going to continue with our bounce around North America to the different flyways and get a little season recap from individuals that are do a lot of hunting in those flyways and just get their opinion on the migration. Was it a normal migration? Was it a slow migration? Was it an early migration? Any thoughts they have? Are the flyways shifting? I just find it interesting to bounce around and talk to these people. So tonight we have Scott Vix on. He is from the Pacific Flyway, California Hunter, Northern California, and he is going to talk to us about the Pacific Flyway. Then in a couple of weeks, let's see, when is that? We're having Jacob Caffrey on 318 that will be released. Jacob Caffrey, he's also Pacific Flyway, but he's a little farther east than what Scott is, so I'm trying to get two from every flyway. So I'm still looking. I have not secured. I want to get someone from up far up in the Central Flyway, Canada, North Dakota area, so that we can get a little better picture of the Central Flyway. And I do have another guest lined up for the Atlantic Flyway for puddle ducks. So that would give us a couple from the Atlantic, a couple from the Pacific. I've already had on two from Mississippi. And so that'll about close it out. I really, this has been interesting to me. And I hope that it's been interesting to you as well. Also tonight, Scott has done a lot of work with sporting clays and has a lot of thoughts on improving your accuracy as a shooter. And so we're going to talk about that as well. I'm really excited to pick his brain about that. What can you do to improve your shooting? If you feel like shooting is your average or a little below average, what can you do to become a better shooter? Is there something other than just shoot a lot of shells? Are there some type of drills that you can do? I know I have my thoughts about it. I have become a pretty proficient shooter, but the main reason I feel like that I've become better at shooting is shot selection. And I'll talk to Scott about that. And also, so I'm excited to have him on and talk to him. Before we bring him on here, let's go ahead and talk about the partners. Final Approach, FABrand.com for all of your waterfowling needs, from decoys to clothing to waders to blinds, everything you need, FABrand.com. And the 10% code off there is FDH10. Motion Ducks Decoy Spreader, get that motion on the water. One of the most important things. Everyone has spinners, but not everyone uses jerk rigs in motion on the water. MotionDucks.com. Again, code is FDH10. And Onyx Hunt. If you haven't downloaded Onyx Hunt, you are playing this game with one arm tied behind your back, quite honestly. I just can't imagine going back to not having Onyx. It's that important. It's that big of a deal. So those are the partners. And tonight, guys, we are having a... This is actually being recorded live in front of the patrons. And so if you want to be a part of watching these recordings live, being able to comment, ask questions, and be a part of it with us, patreon.com/freelanceduckhunting. And I've got a couple hunts over there that you're going to want to see. I can tell you that right now. You're going to want to see these hunts. They are only there, nowhere else. They're amazing. So patreon.com/freelanceduckhunting. Come on over, join us. All sorts of perks over there that you guys can get, and check out these live recordings where you can watch and comment. So let's go ahead now and bring Scott on. So I am joined today by Scott Vix. And as I mentioned on the introduction, he is a California Pacific Flyway duck hunter, and he's going to talk to us about his hunting life out there in, I believe, Northern California, and a little bit more, and what the migration was like for him. And then we're also going to hit on some shooting stuff, because I think that I talked to Scott on the phone last Friday, and he's got some tips that he can help us with to improve our shooting. How are you doing tonight, Scott?
I'm doing well, LA. Very well.
Good. Give us a little bit of background about yourself. Where'd you grow up? When'd you get into hunting? Your hunting life, and relay that specifically to waterfowl hunting.
Okay. Well, I grew up in the East Bay, and I'm 65. And when I was 10, 11 years old, that was really my first hunting. My father was a pheasant hunter, upland. He did a little duck hunting, but it was pheasants for him. And so we'd go and do that. And at that time, he had a 410 Remington 1148 auto that I was able to use. And then my parents separated, and when she remarried.
And this was in California.
This was in California, in the East Bay.
East Bay. Can you? I am clueless about California. Where exactly? Like north, south, east.
Probably 30 miles north of San Jose.
Okay.
And so enter my stepfather. My stepfather was a duck hunter, and my uncle also was a duck hunter. And so, about the age of 12 was really when I got into it. And growing up, basically, my childhood was, I was either duck hunting or I was working. My stepfather was a tile setter, and so I was working with him weekends and things of that nature, or playing baseball. Mm-hmm. There was no tile time. So when it was baseball season, I wasn't working too much in the tile trade, and when duck season came around, weren't playing baseball, and we were hunting ducks. And did that, and when I got into college, I met my best friend, named Doug, and met him in a history class, and we had...
What college did you go to?
It was a junior college at that time.
Okay.
I was going to UOP, but anyways, this was a junior college. Mm-hmm. And we just started talking about hunting. He was a big deer hunter and things of that nature. He had never duck hunted before. So we started duck hunting. And that included driving up to the Sac Valley, driving up to the northeast part of the state to the Lake Lower Klamath Basin, and driving down to the grassland down there by Los Banos. And we've been duck hunting together ever since.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been hunting for 65 minus 12.
Yeah.
53 years. How was this season comparatively to the vast majority of your previous seasons?
For me personally, I did okay. I'm a public land guy. I don't belong to a club. I'm not tied to any one particular area. And I put a lot of miles. I had to work for them. I had to put a lot of miles in. I had to put a lot of time in. But, you know, when you have the experience and you're willing to put in the time and the miles on public land, you can be successful. Mm-hmm. Club-wise, the club guys, they had a really rough year there. It was a really rough year. Up in the Sac Valley, most of the clubs up there are rice clubs, and they struggled a lot. I'm sure there were a few clubs that did okay, and I'm sure there's some natural marsh club that did okay. But for the most part, they really, really struggled. Down the grasslands, they really struggled down there as well. And most down there is natural marshes. So all in all, out here this year was a really rough year.
So you mentioned grasslands, rice fields. For those of us that have never been waterfowl hunting in California and don't know how it functions, are you guys close to mountains? Is it mostly plains? Is it rolling hills? Are you hunting? You said some of them are natural versus man-made. Can you just kind of give me an overview of what the public duck hunting opportunities are for the public freelancers in that area?
When we're talking about the Sac Valley and the grasslands, it's flat. Mm-hmm. It's flat. I mean, if you go up to the Butte Sink, you know, there's hills and mountains up there. But when you're talking crops and you're talking yellow bypass, talking the Tsum Marsh, you're talking the grasslands, it's flat.
How far is that from the ocean?
From the ocean? Well, where I live about 30 minutes west of Sacramento, so that puts me 45 minutes, an hour, I can hit the ocean.
And so from your waterfowl hunting spots, it's an hour to the ocean?
No, from where I live. Oh, well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, you know, there are opportunities to hunt divers, which, you know, some do out in the bay, San Pablo Bay, and inwards towards Grizzly Island, they'll do that. But from where I live, it's about an hour and a half to get up to the Sac Valley, and I'm kind of driving northeast. Mm-hmm. If I'm going home to the grasslands, it's about a 2.5 hour drive, and it's pretty much south. If I'm hunting in the Delta, which there's opportunities and clubs and islands that have clubs out the Delta, that's anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half for me. And if I'm going up to the northeastern part of the state, it's about 4 to 5 hours from where I live.
And all of that is flat, or do you at some point run into the mountains?
If you get up to the northeast, you'll get into some mountains. But Sac Valley, Delta, grasslands, no, it's pretty flat.
And all of these marshes are controlled by the state, or some of them federal? Do they grow moist soil? Do they manipulate the water? Tell me more about just the area in general.
Well, the public land, the public hunting opportunities on the refuge system that we have, mm-hmm. some are state owned, some are federal. And yes, there are programs on controlling water and moist soil management and things of that.
And those are the ones you hear about that have so much pressure, and they have the little concrete holes that people go. I've seen Titus. I'm sure you're probably familiar with Titus at Mid Valley Mercer. Some of his videos, you'll see them using those where they're kind of like little concrete holes you just kind of get down in. Is made blinds, and they tell you where you have to go. Is it free roaming on most of them? Do you have to draw pills?
On the public lands that we have, it's a mixture. There are areas that are free roam. There are areas that are assigned areas. So you have this assigned area, and there's no place you have to particularly be in that assigned area. There's like no structures or anything of that nature. There are some areas that have what they call blind sites. So they'll stick a stake in the middle, and you have to be within like 100 feet of that particular stake. And there are some areas that have regular blinds that you're talking about in the ground where you got to be in the blind.
And are those areas highly pressured and difficult to feel like you're off by yourself when you're hunting those places?
Yeah, you're not going to feel like you're by yourself. No, you know you're going to.
Right. And so that becomes normally pass shooting?
Not necessarily. A lot of it depends on the hunter himself. You know, if the hunter's just going to take a shot at the first bird at a bird the first time they see it, or time of year, weather, you know, November, it's not as pressured, not as many people are hunting. So, yeah, you can have a little more space, and you can have a little more peace and be able to work birds. Later on, it's more pressure. Like down on the grasslands, when the teal come in, and, you know, the teal typically come in mid to late December, a little harder to work birds first thing in the morning. But later on in the day, when teal stop flying and yellow birds come out, you can work them.
And you said, I'm dying to get a better idea of this because I'm getting on Google Earth here. And you said you lived, the closest big town you lived near is San Jose, you said?
No, that's where I grew up, about 40 miles north of San Jose. I currently live about 30 minutes west of Sacramento.
Okay, west of Sacramento. I see it. Okay. All right, good. So that is pretty close to right in the middle of California, maybe a little bit more north than south of California.
You know, like I mentioned earlier, if I'm going to the Sac Valley, I'm an hour and a half to 2 hours. And if I'm going down to grasslands, I'm 2 hours, and there's places in between.
Right. So the duck hunting would be, so you've got like Tahoe National Forest and that's the mountain range. And on the left, you have things like Mendocino National Forest. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the duck hunting lies in between those two basic structures. Looks like you have lots of trees and hills, and so the flats and the grasslands. So Sacramento's right in the middle of it.
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, up in the Mendocino area, there are some smaller opportunities to hunt, but not as far as the refuge system. What we're talking.
So basically, Highway 5 runs all up and down through the duck hunting areas, just straight up. It's all that flatland in between the mountains and the foresty area. Okay. And so the ducks probably migrate just straight down that?
For the most part, they do. Yes. If you're looking at I-5, I mean, you would see on the border, Tule Lake, Lower Klamath Basin, which is really one of the big problems we have here in California right now. It's off of 5. It's not too close to 5, but it's not too far away from 5. But
so do they end up, how far south do the mass to the, where's this kind of the stopping point? Do they get past, do they get to like Bakersfield, LA, or do they get past that? How far down do they go?
typically. And go all the way down to Mexico.
Right. So what species would, like, I know the pintails probably would get clear down to Mexico, but, like, did you have a decent amount of mallards? Are the mallards going to go that far down past, like, San Diego into that area?
Well, they could, but, you know, California is unique in the sense that majority of the mallards that we harvest, we raise.
You raise, so they nest there?
Yeah.
And are those birds that don't migrate at all, or are you just where their hatching ground is?
They migrate around the state. They get real smart.
But they're still migrating birds. They still go south.
They could.
But they're not as weather migration. They're obviously wild mallards, and they're just opportunistic, so there's no real reason for them to get pushed south.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about your pintails, your teal, your widgeon? Do those also nest in that area, or are those coming down out of Canada?
Not so much. We rely on a migration, like I mentioned earlier, typically middle of December, that's when you start seeing the teal.
Middle of what?
December.
Really? And so your season opens in November sometime?
No, our season, we run 100-day season. The balance of the state will open typically like the third weekend of October and runs through January 31st.
Jeez.
The Northeast starts earlier, 1 to 2 weeks earlier, and ends 1 to 2 weeks earlier. As well as when our season's done, the following weekend, we have the junior hunt. And then the following weekend after that, we have the veterans hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we have a late 5-day goose.
So I'm still looking at Google Earth here. So would it be accurate to say that the majority of, and this takes up a huge space, but the majority of the duck hunting are ducks moving in between like Redding and Bakersfield in California? That whole section there that you can see just looks like grasslands on Google.
Yeah, in fact, if you find Kern, there's a public area down there called Kern Refuge, and they do well. But birds will go further south. I mean, you have areas down there in Southern California, West Worcester and the Salton Sea that hunt as well. I'm just personally not real familiar with that.
Right.
I don't go down past Kern.
Okay. No one's ever fully explained to me why California has a 100-day season versus a 70 or 72 or 60, and why they've got a 7-duck limit. Every time I hear about California hunting, I hear about the pressure and how many people are. Is it? Do you know why the days and the numbers are so much more liberal?
I would say because we raise more duck.
Really?
Yeah.
It's hard for me, I'm not saying that's not true. It's hard for me to believe that the more ducks are raised there than like upper North Dakota and in Canada, the central flyway. That's hard for me to understand how that's true.
Well, there are probably somebody better to qualify to answer the question.
It may be. You know, it's probably an equation of number of ducks and harvest numbers from hunters, because if you look at, you know, you look over here in the central flyway, I mean, you know, you've got them hunting from Canada clear down into Texas, and the Mississippi flyway, I mean, you've got so many people hunting in Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, and so many people harvesting birds that it's got to be just an equation of number of birds, a number of hunters, and harvest. So in the air, that area in California is a smaller area, that area from, you know, Redding to Bakersfield, let's say. That's a much smaller area than, say, Canada to Texas. So that's got to just be it. It's the proportionate way more ducks per hunter in the Pacific Flyway than the Central, and obvious than the Mississippi, because they've got so many people up and down that river. That's got to be what it is, wouldn't you think?
Obviously, the amount of harvest has a lot to do with it.
Yeah. What now? You, when we talked on the phone, I think you said you travel up north out of California some as well, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'll make trips up to the Northeast. I'll make trips up into Oregon, and I'll make trips to Idaho as well.
Which of the whole Pacific Flyway do you feel, without giving away any spots, and feel free to lie about this if you'd like to, which state do you feel like pound for pound is just your very best waterfowling state out of Idaho, Oregon, Washington, California?
There are great things about all three places, so I couldn't really say this one's better than that one. I mean, I have had some real good trips in all three places. I definitely enjoy the opportunity that I have here at home, and I enjoy it all. I enjoy getting out on the road. I enjoy seeing new things. I enjoy doing new things. Is there more pressure in Oregon than California? No, there's not. But this is where I grew up, so I kind of have an understanding on how to handle things when I need to handle them, as far as where to go, what to go, and what to do, and manage expectations.
Yeah. And you said you had to struggle a little bit more this year than previous years. Is that because of something was different about the migration itself this year than in normal average years?
Well, the migration was much later. I mean, I know people in Canada. I know people that hunt in Canada, and know a couple of folks that work for some outfitters. And when it's in December and you're talking to folks in Canada and they're playing golf, you know something's going on.
Yeah. For us, is if they're not ice fishing up north, we're struggling. If they've got to be ice fishing by early December. If you're early December, you don't hear that they're ice fishing up there, the birds just aren't going to move. They've got to be, especially the mallards anymore, they've got to be forced down. I mean, there are a good number of mallards that'll just go, and they're calendar migrators, but like the bulks, the masses of them, those days where you see so many mallards that you're just in awe, those birds have to be forced down. And if you're not getting like lakes locked up and people ice fishing up north, that people always start saying they're out here, it's like, yeah, they're not even ice fishing up there yet. And you're like, uh-oh. And that's the way it was this year until the very end. How much late did you guys get that late? I know we got the cold slam here, kind of January-ish, but I never really paid that much attention to the weather out there. Did you guys get that cold hit late too? And did it affect you in the same way it affected us here?
No, we did not get the cold late. I mean, I'll tell you what, I had my trailer down in Los Banos, because I'll stay down there 2 or 3 days, right? I don't drive up and down 2.5 hours every day. And this is the first year that I didn't burn a single full tank of propane. I mean, we had days in January where it got up to 70 degrees.
Jeez.
Probably, shit, I was talking to my one of my partners there, and we were thinking back about you know, some of the weather we were having in January. I think it was like 15 out of 17 days where it was what we call doom and gloom, where it was warm and overcast. And when it's overcast, those birds are really wary. They see everything, you know, and they hear everything. And they get real finicky and real flaky. It was like 15 out of 17 days. I mean, I'd get up in the morning to get in the truck and drive to the check station, and the truck was telling me it was 50 degrees outside.
And this was January?
This was January.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was, you know, there was a couple of days where it got maybe a bit chilly, but it was just really warm. We did not have a whole lot of wind days, and we even had less fog days.
Yeah. And
we just didn't have the cold. Really, the duck weather didn't start until like the first weekend of February. Mm-hmm. Then we got duck weather. And the junior hunt had rain and had some cold, and that particular Sunday was blowing 40 miles an hour. So that's when that happened.
But, yeah.
I mean, everything was late, including the weather. The birds just got tattered. And like I said, you know, typically you'll see the teal come down in the middle of December. I never really saw. I had one big teal flight where I was saying, okay, here they come, here they come. And the next day I was in the same place and I saw about 5% of what I saw the day before.
Really?
They just bounced. You know, they didn't really come down here until into January, and then some of the areas started seeing them, but they didn't really come down before. So.
I have had so many people tell me when it comes to teal, it's like here one day, gone the next, and that is just not my experience with either blue wing or green wings. I mean, for us, if they're here, now, the weather dependent, but if they're just, if they show up one day, they're almost never just gone right after that, unless there's some kind of big weather event to do it. But that seems to be a pretty common, I know people in Arkansas say that about blue wing teal all the time. It's like, it's hit or miss. If it's there, you better get on them, 'cause it's here one day, gone the next. And that, man, I don't know whether where I'm hunting, maybe the food sources are just better or what it is, but that's not my experience. Now with teal, you guys are talking probably mostly green wing, but also cinnamon.
Some cinnamon. Yes. And way more mostly green wing.
Mm-hmm. So how does your breakdown go from, do you track your numbers?
I do.
And normally, just thinking back at your numbers, like for me, over the last 15 years, mallard's number one, blue wings number two, green wings number three, gadwall, I'm not sure what's fifth. That's kind of the breakdown. How does yours, let me guess what yours is. I would guess that it would be probably green wings first.
As far as personal take?
Yeah, harvest numbers. Green wings first, and I'm not sure what would be second. Because I don't think you probably don't kill tons of mallards, but you probably kill a fair share. Maybe mallard second, pintail third, something like that.
No.
What is it?
I kill more mallards.
Really?
Because that's what I'm targeting.
Okay.
That's what I'm going after.
Mm-hmm.
I don't personally have a problem going out. And if I'm targeting mallards and my take is three, but I could have shot seven teal.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't shoot because I'm targeting mallard.
Yeah, and you've been doing it for 53 years. I bet you weren't like that in your early 20s.
Well, when I was in my early 20s, you could shoot a whole heck of a lot more than one sprig, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, right. Have you heard that maybe they're going to move that up to two?
I've heard two. I've heard three. We've been hearing this stuff on and off for eons.
It wasn't too long ago we had a year of two. I think it was only 5, 6, 7 years ago we were at two.
That's
awesome. I want to go back to your, you know, mallards first, and but it frustrates me because all of the modern day biologists say, hey, kills don't affect population. Kills don't affect population. Kills don't affect population. But what's the first thing they do when they're worried about a low population? They reduce the bag limit. It's like you can't have it both ways. You cannot say over and over again that harvest doesn't affect population. And then your first method to deal with a lowering population is to take away. You can't have both, but that's what they do. And maybe it's not this. Maybe it's the biologist saying this and the people who are actually in charge of regulating it. It's probably not the same people, but that frustrates me because it's like if harvest doesn't affect population size, then when we have lower numbers, you should not mess with anything about the harvest because you've said it doesn't matter. But anyway, you can talk about thoughts on that or go back to your mallards first and what other ducks you harvest.
Well,
another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's one thing to talk about reducing limits. It's another thing to talk about reducing days.
Amen.
And so when you start reducing days, that's when you start getting people really, really excited.
Amen to that.
That you start getting people's attention. I mean,
yeah.
You have, you know, a 7 mallard limit out here, and, you know, folks talk about reducing 5. Well, that's not going to help the mallard number. Would have helped the mallard numbers if it's deemed that they need help, which you got to follow the science, right? Can't have it both ways. So if you follow the science, it's taking days away if they need help. And so when you start talking about taking days away, that's when you start getting people.
Yeah. But like I said, my understanding from the biologists that I've talked to and all the modern information says that, you know, we don't have an effect on it. What's going to affect it is whether and habitat. How many we kill is not going to matter. So don't take away the days either. Just focus on habitat and natural weather cycles. Like right now, we're in the third year of a drought. Surprise, surprise, numbers are starting to drop, you know. And hopefully we'll be out of that. But let's jump back into, so mallards are typically the duck that you kill the most. What would be your second, third, fourth?
Be somewhere between widgeon and teal. Widgeon and teal. I mean, you can't put pintails too high up there because you only shoot one.
Right.
And a lot of times I'm in places that you're not going to see. So.
Mm-hmm. I sure wish we had more widgeon. That is, I will kill a mallard drake about more. I'd be more happy about a mallard drake kill than about anything other than just your specialized one-off ducks. You know, like I never see canvas back. I'd love to kill one, but man, there's widgeon when they fly and they bank and you see those white patches and that white strip on the head. There is nothing that excites me more than seeing that, a little group of five. And I mean, I've maybe only shoot 2 or 3, 4 or 5 a whole year. We just don't see that many. It's unfortunate. You guys are really, really the type of birds you guys have. You have such a great wide array of birds. It's really cool. And you've got the cinnamons. Now you don't have the blue wings, but and I love blue wing teal, but you've got those cinnamon and man, and they're always seem to be so plumed out there in California.
Yeah, no, they're a beautiful bird, and we do get a few blue wings. I mean,
okay.
not, but we do get a few, and something that I've done once, and I know my partner Doug's done once, and another friend of mine, Frank, he's done it, and Kevin's done it, is get what you call the trifecta, and that's being able to get a drake green wing, and a drake cinnamon, and a drake blue wing.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Pretty cool.
That. So what would be, if you've got seven ducks, what would be your most ideal limit? For me right now in Kansas, you give me my five mallard drakes in a nice, beautiful pintail. That's like the ideal day. I've only done that a couple of times. What for you would be, what species breakdown for you would be of your seven, just your perfect scenario day?
Well, when you say that, I'd love seven specks.
Yeah, right.
I mean, our limit out here.
Mm-hmm. What about ducks? You've got so many beautiful ducks.
Yeah. If I'm going out for mallards, then it's seven mallards. Mm. If I'm not on a teal shoot, it'd be seven teal. You know, getting a strap full of mallards with a bull sprig, real nice as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you go through the year, you target certain things and target certain areas. And like I said, you gotta manage your expectations, not only for what you're going to see bird wise, but where you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a real big guy on limits.
Mm-hmm.
Got to get a limit. Maybe 30 years ago, I was not real big on that, but if I can go out and say, hey, I'm going to hunt this area and I'm going to see what's going on, because at least my perspective is I want to be in the middle of things, but I want to be on the front edge of things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't in a place where someone says, I should have been here last week, you know? So sometimes you got to get out of your comfort zone, some other things based off of knowledge and experience to get on the leading edge. So when it happens, you're there.
So is that reading the weather and what the habitat is from year to year? Is that the best way for you to feel like you're kind of one step ahead? Since you've been doing it for so long out there, you know the area so well that you're kind of one step ahead, or as you said, on the front edge?
Absolutely. That's why I keep a really good journal. And, you know, my journal, when I get done with the weekend or the day or is I write it in a, like I'm writing a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I put things in there. It's more than just, hey, I went here and shot this. You know, it's what was the weather before? What was the weather the day of? And, you know, what did you hear from this area? What did you hear from this person?
Mm-hmm.
What pressure life and things of that nature. And when you have those, and I can, when was it? It was like in 2018, I noticed much of what was going on was real similar to 2015.
Mm-hmm.
As I prepared for the 1, 2, 3 days of hunting, whatever I was going to do, I would review 2015.
Hmm.
I would say, this is what was happening. This is what was happening. And this is what, you know, the water was, this is what the weather was like, and this is what the bird flight was like. And just reading through 2015 helped me in making decisions about what I was going to do in 2018.
Hmm. That's really interesting. Yeah, that's cool to have that wealth of information logged in your brain and your journal that you can go back and make connections like that. I want to transition over into some gunning stuff. Before we do that, is there anything else that you feel like you want to share about your hunting this year before we jump over to gunning?
Just that I had a nice year.
Yeah.
Every hunting season's a good year.
Mm-hmm.
Just some are better than others.
I had one year that I don't call a good year. I got skunked 45% of my hunts one year. It was 2016. And man, it started to weigh on me. I don't mind a lot of my emotions about hunting or expectations. Like if I don't think it's going to be a great hunt, I'm perfectly happy with a couple good passes. If I think it's going to be a fantastic hunt, then my expectations raise and I'm not as happy with a couple good passes. But going out and not seeing birds and getting skunked half of the time, I'm maybe not mature enough to be able to continue to do that time and time and time again and not become real grouchy about it.
Be grouchy too if it was 40%, but you know, I'm sure you gained a lot of knowledge during, and the things that you learned about what didn't happen or what not to do or what you should have done in 2016, you can apply.
For sure.
And so that's the way I look.
Yep, definitely. Well, let's go ahead and transition into the gunning. Give us a little bit of background. I know you've done some competitive stuff, and I think what you said was sporting clays. So can you give a little bit of background on that? Then I want to get into the techniques and specifics of becoming a better shooter.
Okay, well, going back to growing up, when I was growing up, trap shooting was a big part of the deal.
Uh-oh. Someone's at the front door doorbell.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
And so trap shooting was a big deal. And you know, back then, I mean, you're talking early 70s, mid-70s. Sporting clays really wasn't around. Sporting clays never really made an appearance probably to the early to mid-80s. But I did that. But, you know, once I got into college and other stuff, you know, I didn't really do that anymore. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I go to the skeet range before duck season and shoot a few rounds of skeet and call it good, which is what a lot of guys do now. But probably about 12, 13 years ago, I came across a neighbor that shot competitive tournaments and talked to me about going to one, and I went to one, and I just really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the atmosphere, being around other shooters. Most of them were duck hunters, and things of that nature, and that's when I really got into it. So I kind of got full bore into it. I used to do a lot of saltwater fishing. You talked about how far away am I from the ocean. Well, I'd be able to pull my boat out of the driveway and drive over to Marin, launch the boat, tack out of the harbor, and I'd be underneath the Golden Gate Bridge in an hour and a half.
Hmm.
And so I used to do a lot of saltwater fishing, but I'm the kind of guy that once I get into something, I get into it. And so I got into it, pulled my boat. I'll still go fish, you know, once in a while, but I don't do it 5% of what I used to do. And got into sporting clays, and I joined the NSCA, National Sporting Clays Association, which is based out of San Antonio. They hold registered shoots throughout the whole country. And I started to learn how to be a wing shot through clay targets. And it's one of the best things I did for my hunting, because we can talk about the weather, and we could talk about duck calling. We could talk about being in the spot, and it's all very true. It's all very important, but where the rubber meets the road is executing the shot.
Mm-hmm. What do you feel like is the most important factor in being a, let's say, extremely competent wing shooter in the field?
Oh. There's a couple ways I could answer that, but I'll tell you, you can't buy skills.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, you know, guys will, I read them all the time, you know, well, I'm going to buy this to be a better shot. And I'm going to buy that to be a better shot. And I'm going to switch ammo. I'm going to get a new choke tube and things of that nature. And granted, you know, you have to have good equipment. You got to have a good shotgun. You got to have a shotgun that fits. You got to have a shotgun that's reliable. You got to have it choked right. You know, you got to know what it's what the pattern's like and what the ammunition that you're using. You got to have all that stuff, but you also have to have the skill set to be able to go execute it and make it work. And if guys would just invest in themselves instead of just investing in equipment, they'd be much better off.
And by that, you mean just practice more?
Well, yeah, practice more, but then you got to ask, what are you practicing? Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody wants to play golf, do you play golf?
No. I mean, I have during my life, but no.
Exactly. Okay, so say you got bit by the golf bug, mm-hmm. and you really wanted to learn how to play. Would you just go out there and start hacking away?
No, I would do some sort of swing analysis right off the bat.
Well, there's a swing analysis, or find somebody that's competent that can either show you something, mm-hmm. then you would do that.
Right.
And, you know, and it's the same thing with learning how to duck call. You know, a lot of guys want to play by ear. And when it comes to shotgunning, you know, well, I can pick up a gun and I can shoot this and they go out. And look, there's a lot of good wing shots out there that's never had any help or formal instruction or anything else, you know. But invest in yourself and get a good foundation. You don't have to necessarily go to an instructor. I mean, there's stuff online that you can watch that would help you. But you got to get out on the range and you got to pull a trigger if you want to get proficient with a shotgun. And one thing when folks come to me and, you know, getting back into what you asked me earlier, I mean, you know, competing, you know, going through the ranks, you know, starting D class, and then when you're more successful, then you move to C class, B class, A class. I mean, I shot master class for, you know, 8 or 9 years. And then I went through a certification, NSCA certification on instructing. And I work with a lot of kids, work with a lot of new hunters. I work with just duck hunters that say, hey, look, I'm having problems with this. I'm having problems with this shot. We'll work on this. And, you know, we'll do that. And the one thing that I'll start new people with is talking about looking at the target.
Mm-hmm.
Eyesight. You know, do you know what you're dominant on? Mm-hmm. I mean, people think because they're right-handed, the right eye dominant. Not necessarily true. And then there's different degrees of being right eye dominant. Some people are dominant, non-dominant. They're right in the middle. Their left mm-hmm. eye is the right eye. Because, you know, the probably most important thing about shooting is getting that visual connection with the target, being able to look at the target, being able to understand how to look at a target. I'll throw a target out. I'll ask somebody that's seeing me or a new shooter, and I'll say, okay, here's a target, and it's an orange target, and I'll throw it and I'll say, what do you see? They'll say, oh, you know, look at me with that. What are you talking about? I see an orange target flying through the air. Okay, look at it again. Tell me what you see. I see an orange target. Okay, now I'm going to throw it again. What I want you to do is I want you to look in the middle, because with the way the sun is right now, that target, you know, the clay targets, it has a ridge on the ends, and in the middle is sunken. And so that target's going in the air, and the sun is casting a shadow. There's a shadow right in the middle of that target. So I'm going to throw it again, see if you see that shadow. I'll throw it again. I'll say, yeah, there it is. Or you could throw a black target, and the sun will shine right on the front edge mm-hmm. of the... When... you've trained yourself to look and look right and look hard at a target, and you got to time it because your eyes can only get into a hard focus. You go from a soft focus to a hard focus. Your eyes can only get into a hard focus for about a second, second and a half. So if you're looking, you see a flock of geese or 200 yards away and they're coming in, and you're saying, okay, I got to really look hard, man. Scott said, get in the hard focus, and I got a really hard focus, and they're 200 yards away. Well, by the time they get to you and you're going to do the shot, you know, your eyes are done because they can't stay in hard focus that long. But it's really understanding when you got a mallard coming in, a mallard's on the bank and cup the wings and it's coming in, do you see the mallard or do you see the white ring around the neck? Do you see the mallard or do you see the yellow bill? If you see the yellow bill, if you see the white ring around the neck, now you're really looking at the target. If you get that visual connection, your hands will follow your eye. And you'd be amazed at what getting that visual connection with the target and being able to move with the target and sync with the target and what it'll do. Just completely keeping your eyes on the target, not looking at the barrel, not checking the gap, not trying to measure, syncing with the target. You'd be amazed at the shot you could pull off.
I have never heard anyone talk about that before. That's fascinating. I'm letting that sink in a little bit. So do you believe that shooting is, and I'm sure there's a combination, but which one is more important between mechanics, natural ability, and practice?
That's a good question. I don't know how much natural ability you have. I don't know how much natural ability anybody has, but this is what happens is you gain knowledge, whether it's through an instruction, whether you read it in a book, whether you saw a YouTube video. You know, there's lots of good information out there. I can give you some names and give some folks to look up. There's lots of good information out there. You get this information. So you read it, got it, you get this information. Now you take that knowledge and you go practice. You go practice that. You're consciously practicing that. You are building a skill. Just because you understand it doesn't mean that you can do it. Mm-hmm. So you go and you practice and you shoot, whether it's on a sporting clay course. You know, Skeet's a good place to practice well. But you practice, you shoot, you build the skill because you want to make that knowledge and you want to make that skill into a subconscious effort. The best shooting is done subconsciously. Want to be not thinking about, oh, I've got to float the bird. Oh, I got to get a 6-foot lead on the bird. You know, you don't want to do that. So you want to be shooting subconsciously. All the, you know, your mounts and your, you know, insertion to the target. Okay, I got to do that. You want it to be subconscious. Your conscious mind can only do one thing at a time. Your subconscious does hundreds, thousands of things at a time. So if a bird's coming in and you're starting to think, man, I got to float the bird. I'm going to have to float the bird. Well, you're going to float the bird because you're thinking about floating the bird. But your insertion, your move, really seeing the bird, getting a visual connection, that ain't going to work because your conscious mind can only do one thing at a time. You don't want to be thinking about the one thing when there's many other things you got to do to be able to execute the shot. So you, if how many times I know this happened to me, you're sitting there, you know, for 2 hours and you haven't seen a bird. And all of a sudden you look out there and here's this greenhead. He's 10 yards on the deck and he's flying right at you. And you're saying, wow, this is going to be good. I've been here for 2 hours, but this is going to be good. This is going to be the start. And you get down and you grab your call. You say, man, I don't need to call because it's coming right at me. And it's coming and it's coming and it's coming and it's coming. And you're saying, okay. And all of a sudden you start thinking, don't screw this up, man. Don't screw this up, man. Dude, come on, dude. Come on. Come on closer. Come on closer. And you stand up and you go bang, bang, bang.
Nothing.
And nothing. Don't tell me that didn't happen to you, man.
No, I, never. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Now, why? Because you're thinking about everything else, what you should have been thinking about. Mm-hmm. Okay, which is seeing the bird. All right. So now the bird goes by and you sit down and the first thing you think of is, man, I'm sure glad nobody was here to see that, man.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to go turn the camera off, and you look at Georgie, and Georgie says, hey, what's up, man? What's up? You know? And so now it's 5 minutes later, and you're looking that same direction, and you're thinking about that bird, and all of a sudden from behind you, you hear that drake quack. You hear that quack, and you know there's a drake. And you get down, and you look over your left shoulder, and there it is, and you just instinctively go, bang.
Right.
And you kill it. Mm-hmm. And it was a harder shot than the other one was. And you nail it because you didn't think about it. You took your skills, and it subconsciously, and you executed the shot. Mm-hmm. So take knowledge, practice, and you make yourself, you know, get that skill level so ingrained, you become a subconscious shooter. Now, along the lines of the conscious mind is going to be thinking about something. So you got to give it something to think about. If you don't give it something to think about, it will find something to think about, and it's normally not going to be good. So when I call for a clay target, or when I got a mallard coming in the decoys, or I got a flock of teal coming in, what do I think about? I think about the same thing. Look at the bird. Mm-hmm. Look at the bird. See the bird. And sometimes it could be a phrase, you know, I always hard focus, or it could be look at it, you SOB, you know, whatever works for you, whatever resonates with you. But whenever I call for a target, or whenever I pull up on a target, whenever I pull up on a bird, the only thing I'm thinking of is looking at the bird, seeing the bird.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I started keeping track of my own personal shooting percentage around 2007, and I'd only shot for a season over 50% one time. I had some seasons where I shot mid 30s, which is not very good, obviously. And I had one season I shot over 50%, and I started making it a real focal point for me. It's that this was a goal I wanted to be a shoot a higher percentage. I don't know if I've become much better shooter, but the number one thing that helped me was shot selection. I realized that I am shooting, especially my third shell, I am shooting shots that my chance of doing anything but crippling that bird, like the most likely scenario on my third shots is that the bird's crippled and I lose it. And I'm like, so I eliminated that third shot. I got really focused on my shooting percentage. And since I did that, and then I accompanied that with a shot cam, and I don't know if you've ever used a shot cam before or not, I realized it had been pounded into me from my father and my uncle. It was like, when you miss, the chances are you're behind it. I had been told that so many times that when I missed, a lot of times I was actually in front of birds, and I saw that through the shot cam, is that I was overleading way more than I was ever behind them. And so those two things propelled me to the point where I normally shoot high 50s now. A couple times I've been in the low 60s. And for me, I know there's people that are a lot more competent than that. And if they're keeping track, they're in the 70s. I am left eye dominant, heavily left eye dominant. And so I close my left eye. I've thought about the idea of trying to retrain myself, but I close that left eye. And one thing I noticed, and this is my question for you, using the shot cam, I've noticed this because I've seen a lot of shot cam footage. When I pull the trigger, my barrel bounces way more than normal people. So you can see that on the shot cam. You pull the trigger and my barrel flies up a lot more distance than what other people I see using a shot cam. And so my question to you is, as far as that muzzle control, what is that a big deal? Is that something I should try to rectify where between shot and two, if I'm getting a lot of movement in my barrel between shot and two, I would think that that would make me a poor shooter on those follow-up shots. Is that something that you've ever thought about or advice for me on, other than just holding the gun tighter? It's something I want to try to fix, but don't really know what to do about that.
Okay. Don't hold the gun tighter. That's not going to help you. Okay. What you're talking about is muzzle jump.
Mm-hmm, right.
And yes, that's a real thing. And that's a big reason why, like, my tournament shells, I shoot a 1 ounce shell at 1180 to 1200 feet a second. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that shoot 1250s. There's a lot of people that shoot 1300s and a lot of people that shoot 1350s. And I'm talking about lead target lows. I'm not talking about steel lows. Right. Right. And reason why I shoot that light and that slow is because of recoil and muzzle jump. Mm-hmm. The first thing I would, and you know, there are other ways you'll see a lot of tournament shooters shoot with ported barrels. And the reason why they shoot with ported barrels is because it helps with muzzle jump. There are chokes, and does it help a lot? Probably not a lot. Does it help some? Probably some. But the first thing I would tell you is look at your ammunition. Mm-hmm. And what are you shooting? If you're shooting, okay, I know you shoot an auto. If you're shooting an auto and you're shooting an Allison 3/8 and 1550, some, you know, big load, fast load, if you lighten that up, either a lighter shot charge or less speed, mm-hmm, that's going to help.
That's going to help it. Okay.
That's going to help with that. And, you know, your point of being in front, being more in front or being behind, I heard those things too. Like I said, man, I used to go crap shooting, you know, and I hear it all the time. And, I hear it on sporting clay courses all the time. You know, you get, you know, four or five guys and they're in there and, you know, the guy's standing, you know, 10 feet behind the shooter and the guy's shooting and he's yelling, you're behind it, you're behind it, you're behind it. Well, that's the symptom. That's not the problem. because case in point, getting back to seeing the bird and, you know, merging correctly and syncing with the bird, moving with the bird. If you're not doing that, you may think you're behind it. Maybe you're not. Case in point, if you had, take a bird, clay target or a duck, take a clay target, and you're 35 yards away and it's going left to right. Okay. It's the same target, same speed, doesn't matter how fast it is. And the first time you shoot at it, you insert it right on the front edge and you move the bird, or I say you move the barrel, and you were 3 feet in front of the bird when you pulled the trigger. You insert it 3 feet in front. I'll do a maintain lead. You insert it 3 feet in front of the target, and you move with the target, and when you pull the trigger, you were 3 feet in front of the target, and you hit it. And you say, great. The next time you call for the target, you insert it, and you were on the back edge, a half a foot on the back edge of the target. And so now you got to move to catch up to it, right? Mm-hmm. So now you move to catch up to it, and now you get 3 feet in front and you pull the trigger and you didn't hit it. Then the next time you call for the target, you said, well, man, I was behind that target, so I'm not going to be behind that target this time. So now you insert it and you are 5 feet in front of the target when you insert it. And you said, well, I'm too far in front. I got to slow down that 3 foot margin. And you slow the barrel down and you shoot and you didn't hit it. Why didn't you hit it? You were 3 feet in front of it all three times, right?
I would assume, going back to what you said, that you're not letting your instinctual self, you're focusing on the wrong things, maybe?
Well, I'm going to tell you why. Because when you insert it behind, you had to increase your gun speed, your barrel speed, to catch up to it. And then you had to push out to get to that 3 foot. And then when you got that gap picture in your head, you pull the trigger. Well, it takes X amount of time for the brain to say, pull the trigger, send the signal down to your finger, and then for your finger to actually pull the trigger. Your gun's moving too fast. You shot in front of the bird. The other time, when you inserted too far in front, you're looking at the bird and you're saying, I'm too far in front. So what do? You slow the barrel down. So now you slow the barrel down and now you get to that 3 foot, you pull the trigger, you're moving the gun too slow, you shot behind the bird.
Makes sense. So how do you control all that?
It's visual, seeing the bird, and whether you're a swing through shooter that's coming from behind the bird, or whether you're a stretch or pull away shooter, or whether you're a maintained lead shooter, those are three different methods and they all work. Some work better than others in any one given particular application, but it's understanding what you're trying to do and getting on the target and controlling the target, controlling your barrel in sync with the bird, with the target. That makes sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. It does make more sense. That's a lot of information and a lot to think about. Would you agree that someone coming off a season where they didn't shoot very well and they don't have at their disposal a lot of coaches, a lot of people that can help them, but they know they're just not shooting well, that just getting out and shooting as much as possible and just the repetition of that is the best way to solve it? Or are there drills that you can do? I know that one time I was having problems shooting out of a layout boat. And so I went into my, I did like three or four sessions in my garage where I laid in my layout boat. I sat up like I was shooting and I pointed at targets on the wall. Now, maybe this was just the confidence I needed to do better. There's a chance of that. But I felt like that drill made a big difference and was a turning point for me with my shooting out of a layout boat, because shooting out of a layout boat is a whole different animal than standing up and shooting.
Hard. It's hard, man. It's so tough.
Are there some drills people can do, or do you just say, hey, if you don't have a lot of resources, just go shoot and shoot as much as you can?
No, I wouldn't. Well, if they do it in a fashion of not just shooting to shoot, because basically all you're doing is just ingraining bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, a guy trying to learn how to duck call. You know, well, should you just blow the duck call? Well, yeah, you need to practice, but you also need a foundation and some instruction on what you're doing mm-hmm. with the duck call. And it's the same thing with shooting. There's lots of information that's available, and there's probably more resources available to people than people think they are.
Mm-hmm.
As far as getting a foundation, understanding, you know, techniques, understanding methods, understanding mounts, you know, how to properly mount the gun, making sure the gun fits right, you know, looking at your ammunition, making sure you're shooting something that's good for you. And recoil is a big part of that. I'm not a big fan of recoil. It doesn't help you. And, you know, most duck hunters, when they think about recoil, well, it didn't knock me on my butt, I'm okay. And, you know, if you're going out and you're shooting, you know, 15 times, 18 shells, yeah, it's not going to knock you on your butt. But being able to get off that shot confident and not getting ready to flinch because you know you're going to get hit, and being able to get the second shot off, you know, whether it's on the same bird or the second bird, recoil matters. Recoil matters.
Well, man, we've gone through a lot here, and I appreciate you coming on and be willing to give up a bunch of your time. I think we're going to end that there and let everyone just kind of think about kind of some of the things that you've said. If you guys want to talk about this topic or ask questions about this topic, hit me up. I'm looking for some comments of the week, and I can relay those back over to Scott. If we get enough questions and we need to have him back on, we can always do that. So you can pose questions over at the Facebook group, the North American Waterfowler Facebook group, or on Instagram, Freelance Duck Hunting, or email me, freelanceduckhunting@gmail.com. And we can put those questions together. I'm going to do a big Q&A podcast, which I have not done with the North American Waterfowler real soon. So let's get those questions in. Comment of the week twice a month, two or three times a month. And would love to hear more from you guys and what your feedback is on this podcast. Well, Scott, thank you again for joining me. You have any final parting words before we close off here?
I appreciate the opportunity to do this. I hope it came off as intended. I got to show you this. Are you a Kansas City Royals fan?
Absolutely.
Good. Man, I got to show you this right here. Recognize that guy? That's Mad Bum, man. That's Madison Bumgarner.
Okay. Get that out of my face. I thought that was going to be something that was enjoyable for me.
No, I got to do that, man, because I'm a 49er fan, man.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to watch number 15 do it again. So
I'll tell you, our two cities have done some battle in the last year.
I'm telling you, man, I was watching that game and there was like 5 minutes left and the Niners were on that drive. And mm-hmm. I told my son, I said, I hope they eat up a lot more time. You cannot give the ball to number 15, man. Nope. And they did it again. But
do you have any thoughts about that game? I would, being someone that's such a fan out there, I don't want to go on another 30-minute segment or anything, but I would love, what are your thoughts of the game? Before you answer that, Madison Bumgarner, those of you who don't know, dominated the Royals in the, what was it, 2014 or 15?
2014.
Right, because we won it in 2015. It was in the World Series. Madison Bumgarner absolutely won the World Series for San Francisco, for sure. He won the World Series for them.
Yes, he did.
And so, yes, yeah, he is an annoying figure in this city. But what are your thoughts of the Chiefs-Niners game?
The thought of the Chiefs-Niners games, I thought that you guys were real lucky that Drake Greenlaw got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that when it was 3rd and 4, they should have ran McCaffrey 2 times. I can't understand why the Niners did not block Chris Jones, man, on that play.
I don't know that, but I don't know that that individual is blockable. I mean, obviously you can touch him.
yeah. And you can at least, you know, do something because Ayuk was open in the end zone.
Yeah.
But, losing Greenlaw was real bad. When the Niners got soft on defense, that was bad. And, you know, Mahomes did his thing, man. Yeah. I mean, he's just that guy. You know, we had a guy like that here at one time too, number 16. But yeah. Mahomes is that guy. So he did it again.
I wonder about, and I agree with you about Mahomes, but if you look at the quarterbacks that have played for Andy Reid, every single quarterback that he has touched plays about 50% better. You go back to like Cobb, you can go Michael Vick, who is their main quarterback for the Eagles for so many years. Actually, I can't believe I can't think of his name. Yes, McNabb. He wasn't that great. Every quarterback that you look at, the backups that come in when the Chiefs need them, every quarterback that Andy Reid touches plays about twice above their level. And I mean, you can look for years and years and years and years, and that's been the case. And I believe that Mahomes is great, but I think if you took, like, if you flip-flopped Josh Allen and Mahomes, I think you would probably be seeing the same thing, except it would be Josh Allen. Or let's take a lesser quarterback, someone that's maybe the next level down, even. I just feel like Andy Reid is the quarterback whisperer, and every quarterback that plays for him plays out of his mind. It's unbelievable.
He's a great coach. He is.
Well, I did not see that Madison Bumgarner thing coming, so that was pretty well played. That was pretty well. But now you probably remember that World Series pretty well because we came down to the 9th inning, and we had a chance to try to go for the tie, and they held up Alex Gordon at third base versus trying to send him home. I don't know if you remember that play.
Oh, I remember that play.
And I still contend they should have just sent him. I mean, they should have just go for it. Send him and see what happens. He probably would have been thrown out, but I think they should have at least gave it a go and sent him.
Well, yeah.
That was a hell of a World Series, though. That was a fantastic World Series.
It was a great day because it was a duck hunting day. And so I went out and hunted, and I told my partner, I said, hey, this time here I'm leaving, and I didn't care what I had, and feed over to my son's house and watch the game with him and had some Bronco Billy's pizza. And it just made everything really, really good.
Yeah. That loss didn't sting that bad because we hadn't been to the World Series since 1985, since I was in seventh grade. I mean, the Royals had been the worst franchise in baseball for 20 years. So just mm-hmm. the fact that we were there was the trophy. I mean, it hurt, but not like a lot of the Chiefs' losses in the playoffs hurt after they were good, but year after year after year, like what Buffalo's going through now, where it's just like we're good and we just can't do it. Where some of those Chiefs' losses were just brutally painful. But that Royals loss in that World Series was not that bad. And then we followed up the next year and win it. So, you know, good times.
And I got to say, that interview you had with Matt Light.
Mm-hmm.
That was good.
Well, thank you.
That was good. That was really good. Good listening.
I really enjoyed that conversation, and I'm glad to hear you say that, because it's hard to gauge. You know, I'm recording it, so it's hard for me to gauge the quality sometimes of how things come off. So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, it was good.
So, let's go ahead and close this thing down. We can talk a little bit more off air. And once again, those of you that are listening, if you want to watch these podcasts live and be able to chat, we got a whole chat string here that's been going on for quite a while. That's patreon.com/freelanceduckhunting. All right. So signing off, until next time, you have listened to another episode of the North American Waterfowler Podcast.